I'm going to read just one statement from this book on witchcraft that Charles Burns wrote, because it does it's kind of a neat statement about an experience that I think is true for a lot of us, is when we are defending Christianity or fighting for it, that we find out in exact terms what we really believe. A lot of times it's not when we're being positive and agreeing with everybody and nodding our heads, but it's when somebody is in controversy with us that our definitions become clarified and more accurate. And he says it this way: it was not the mysteries of Christendom, but its definitions that were alien to contemporary thought and feeling. The supernatural was allowed, was even welcomed, so long as it was not intellectually and dogmatically defined. The half-allegorical gods of Rome, the symbolical and feverish divinities of the East, were very ready to welcome another god. It was the new god who refused to welcome them. Now that's extremely important because of, well, I think all the sentences are important, but I wanted you to notice that the mysteries of Christendom are not what caused the rupture in the Roman Empire and why they disliked the Christians. The supernatural was allowed and welcomed as long as it was not intellectually and dogmatically defined. As long as you're willing to sort of be in a kind of a, oh yeah, I feel that way too about it. You know, I feel that way about nature. Well, yeah, well, you call it God, I call it nature. You know, but we feel the same way about it. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? I mean, it's that kind of fuzzy feeling thinking. Now that isn't really thinking, it's just feeling. And the one thing that Williams insisted on was the importance of the intellect. Now he was not talking about, you know, intellectualism with quotation marks. It was not any kind of sort of an elite intelligentsia that he was writing to. But he was talking about all of us who have minds, that it is with our minds that we learn to know the truths of God. We experience them with our total beings, but if you're going to articulate it, it has to become something that comes out of your head, because it's your language and all that goes into making up statements and sentences. And as long as you're not going to be definite about it, in other words, if you don't care about the definitions, you can get along with anybody. And that's why you have to be really careful when you recommend Williams to someone, that you don't, they can go ahead and read him, as I said before, as just a really good novel, really exciting, and that's fine. But the thing is that that they are going to get caught in definitions, and I would say that if you recommend it to someone to read, be sure you catch up with that person and talk to them about the book, because then the recommendation has some meaning. The fact that you recommended it will have some meaning to them, because you know yourselves that there's a lot in Charles Williams that can give you a feeling of creepy, misty, musty, moisty kind of an experience. And yet, if you're not alive to it, you may not catch the clues to the kingdom, which are there. So just remember that it was not the mysteries of Christendom, but its definitions that were alien to contemporary thought and feeling. The supernatural was allowed, was even welcomed, so long as it was not intellectually and dogmatically defined. And the gods of Rome and the divinities of the East were ready to welcome another god, but it was this god that was not so ready to welcome them. And of course, that's what makes people say that, you know, Christians are really piggish and stubborn and one-track and intolerant. Well, I must say that I guess I'll have to read you a little explanation of tolerance as Williams explains it. What do we understand by tolerance? Tolerance meant, at worst, sullenly putting up with what one could not alter. At best, willingly accepting what one could not alter. It was a little limited by the fact that to tolerate was always considered as an active and hardly ever as a passive verb. One always tolerated and rarely was tolerated. And just remember that. How many times have you thought about yourself as being tolerant of other people, of course? Do other people have to be tolerant of you? Oh no, the person who's tolerant is the tolerator. And you know, one always tolerated and rarely was tolerated the idea that others had, so to speak, to put up with oneself was rarely practiced deeply and consistently. But such as it is, toleration was and remains a noble virtue, yet a virtue which serves best as a guide to something greater than itself. I think it's kind of a good thing because of the fact that tolerance gets to be such a big thing in our world of namby-pamby niceties, and tolerance is what really blurs all definitions finally. In terms of actually, if you're going to get involved with dogma. So Williams is interesting in that, as you see, he calls tolerance a virtue. He says this is something that, I mean, don't write it off. In other words, you're not supposed to clobber everybody that doesn't agree with you, and hopefully they won't clobber you. I mean, if possible, it's fine to be in a state of sweet reasonableness with one another and be able to talk freely and openly. But when it comes to actually the definitions of something, then you have to be sure that you know what you're saying, and that tolerance or no tolerance, you're going to be consistent with what you can consider to be the truth. Now, John wanted me to read one section on the images. Do you think he still wants me to do that, Elise? I thought we didn't have very much time today, and I wanted to be sure to get to the descent into hell. But what I think I'll do is I think we'll start on the descent into hell and discuss that, and then if I don't have time to read this on the images, I'll put it on the tape so that it will be there, because it is something that John referred to, I guess, in his discussion on Prufrock, and he said he felt that you should have it because of the fact that it had some bearing on his explanations and discussions of Eliot and what you will be doing with the Wasteland. So, but I was a little concerned that since we had to start late that you might. And I'd been promising this descent into hell discussion for so long, I was afraid you'd forget how to get there. We can't have that happen. the first thing that I would like to say about the descent into hell, and then I'm going to ask you some questions about your problems with it, is that the basic theme of the novel is that of exchange, the way of exchange in terms of the positive kind of Christian living. In other words, that the kind of exchange that Peter Stanhope does for Pauline when he carries her doppelganger, and the kind of exchange that Margaret sends Pauline on when she goes out to meet her ancestor, you remember, John Strother, who was martyred some centuries previously. That's the positive side of it, when there are a lot of ramifications of that, as you recall. The other side is that from which the book takes its name, the descent into hell. The descent into hell comes from the story of Lawrence Wentworth, who is the famous military historian, who actually, by his own choice, gradually takes the ladder that goes down, and more he is sucked into this the circles of hell, so that although his actual descent into hell, the final the conclusion of it doesn't occur till the end of the book, you know that he is a part of this because of the chapters that deal with his experience are are obviously descriptions of his having already made the decisions to go into hell. And this is true, I think this is important, because very often you find people talking about, I can't believe a religion where a God condemns people to hell. You know, that's really unfair. You know, that's terrible. How can you say God is a God of love if he sends people to hell? Williams and Lewis and McDonald and this whole group of people, and many other people as well, but they are the people that put it forth imaginatively, are very clear in showing us that nobody sends you to hell. You decide to go to hell yourself. Mm-hmm. And I don't care how many times somebody tells you to go to hell, you don't have to go, and certainly not on somebody's behest, which is usually in anger. But it's an actual decision on your part. The other image that is extremely important in the book is one that you may have skipped over, I don't know, but it's the image of Gomorrah. Now, I don't know how many of you remember who it was that really got into Gomorrah very definitely in this novel. And actually, it's because Wentworth was a part of Gomorrah that he finally descends permanently into hell. But do you remember the person that really, you would say, was involved in identifying him? Those of you who've read it, remember? Wentworth was, but who else? Who do you really read about as really sort of kind of an interesting little description of her experience? Adele. Remember, when she's going to marry Hugh, she's sort of had it in her mind, but she begins to get a little queasy on the subject. And then she has this little conversation with Pauline about the play that they're having in the that they're producing, and she wants to she asks Pauline if Pauline will ask Peter Stanhope if he won't can't you get him to put on the play in London, and I'm sure I could get some money for it. I can get a little theater, and I think we should be allowed to put it on because we really have been part of it. And Pauline tries to pin her down to telling the truth, and she continually evades it. Remember what she says? What is it that Pauline is really irritated about? She really has trouble with it.
She's doing it for him.
And then she's doing it for all the others. And Pauline says, "What do you mean? Don't you want it for yourself, Adele?" Because of course Adele had the leading role. She was the princess. And she says, "Don't you want it for yourself? Really? Tell me. And no, Pauline will not come right out, and she will not admit that she is the, that she really wants it for her own, and she, and you find, you know it from the previous description, that she has already figured out that she could direct it a lot better than Mrs. Perry, who had directed it, and she would take it over in London and do a proper job, because she'd always wanted to direct plays anyway. She thought she could do a much better job on it. So this was all in the paragraph before this, or so, from someplace, some pages before. But you get that as a running comment beforehand, and then when she comes to the discussion with Pauline, and Pauline, you know, challenges her on it, and Pauline is very gentle with her, really, but firm. She just keeps on nudging her and saying, you know, she's trying to get her to commit herself. If she would be honest about it, you see, she won't go into Gomorrah. If she could just say right out, I want to do it because I think I could do it better, and I think that, and I really feel that I deserve it. But it's always for somebody else. It's for the benefit of the others. It's for Peter's benefit. Well, Peter didn't need it, but I mean, all these things are built up as a kind of a, yep.
That would keep her out of Gomorrah.
Well, the thing that would keep her out of it, at least for the time being, is the fact that she faced herself. Then Pauline could challenge her on the fact that at least, she, you know, that she was telling the truth, but then she would realize that is an egocentric, you know, completely I sort of a building thing that she wanted done with the play, instead of living in this non-decision, non-challenge ego position, which is what Gomorrah is. Gomorrah is a place of no decision, where you're continually evading any challenge to see yourself as you really are. You see what I mean?
Time for decision and indecision, or yeah. Taking toast and tea?
Yeah, right, taking toast and tea instead. But it doesn't mean that all decisions have to be made at once. You know, it doesn't mean that your life should be existential at every point. But it does mean that when you are challenged, and that when you realize that this is, and you see, for Adele, this was a really deep challenge, because you remember she decides, then after that you see her corruption going very obviously. She wants to go back to Wentworth, and he pushes her out because he's got a good substitute that he's living with, and he's able to control that. So he's not interested in Adele, and he really likes the substitute better than the real thing.
I'm so married to the substitute.
It's a figure of Lawrence Wentworth's dream life that he has made up, that is a sort of a demonic thing that he lives with, because it's something he can manipulate. It's his own, something out of his own kind of imagination that he actually lives with. And he, you know, it's the way Williams describes it, you know, it's almost a living being. You really feel that it's a devilish kind of person that's there. And yet it is, in actual fact, it's a psychological thing that can happen to people.
I thought the part about Gomorrah and the demonic really came up with this fear of running into the real world,
mm-hmm.
hiding away.
Yes, at the beginning. Field. Yes, yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
Peter, at the Genesis Bible study, I wasn't quite... Peter, are you on the other
yes,
side?
Yes, he's on the other side, but he'll have to...
Remember that good comment you made about Wentworth and that fiction about the female side of him?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I think that... I don't know if I can say exactly what I did then, but...
Well, you can say the new way. Mm-hmm. All right.
But I think that he loses Adele, you know, he loses his reality check, and so this fancy of his is pretty to go. And I think that's a possibility for any one of us. Because the temptation is to live in relation to our fantasies rather than live with the people around us.
Yeah, I thought in the example that I remember now we started talking about needs and weaknesses and how in marriage the need and weaknesses were as in his fantasies, it's satisfying your needs. And it's like the example that you gave was something like if you've gone with a love or something and you've broken off, you know, and then you think back about that and the letters and the things like that, and then it's like my masculine fantasy. The masculine side of me becomes my fantasy, you know, which I, you know, was really scary mm-hmm. to me because I just had never thought about that like that. You know, it was coming out in remembrances of mm-hmm. needs mm-hmm. and not weaknesses.
I think this this is part of what the chapter that refers to this particular experience is called the Return to Eden, and it's everybody's, and this is where it refers to this. It's this idea of returning to something that is what you think is going to be perfect, the perfect marriage, the perfect romance, the perfect home, the perfect anything, or the perfect scholarship, which of course is his other handle on life, is the fact that he was a scholar, Lawrence Wentworth. And as he goes into this kind of a fantasy world, this whole chapter is involved in a description of a real, almost Eden-like garden that he goes into with a lot of kind of mossy, shady feelings of, I mean, you don't have any feeling of the brilliance of the original Eden, but you have the feeling of an imitation of it as it looks to us if we want it the way we want it, you know. And that's his whole approach. And he says on page 82, he sees this woman coming towards him, and he knew it could not be Adela, for even Adela had never been so like Adela as this. Mm-hmm. That truth which is the vision of romantic love, in which the beloved becomes supremely her own adorable and eternal self, the glory and splendor of her own existence, and her own existence no longer felt or thought as hers, but of and from another, that was aped for him then. That was aped for him then. See, it was as if instead of the person of Adele, who was at that point still an independent person, the real Adele, she was Williams is very, very strong and very articulate on this understanding that if you are in love with a person, that person has all his or her being from God, and that person has an independence and a quality of life that belongs to herself or himself, and is related first and foremost as a gift from God, but is also related to you. But you have no right to manipulate that person. You can't control that person because it's like saying you can turn God into your own works in ways, you know. And sometime we'll have to, some if any of you are interested, we'll have to discuss this whole theology of romantic love, because that is basic to all of Williams's writings, is the analogy of love in the human sense, analogous to the love of God for man and man for God. And when you think of it, it sounds, if you don't go through it carefully, it sounds like some kind of sentimental trash, you know. Well, you know, that's typical. That's just exactly what Kierkegaard said. That's the only way women had any rebirth was when they fell in love. And that's the only soul they had was by deriving it from their husbands. And, you know, that's the way you would, that's your, sort of your instantaneous reaction to somebody who talks about theology of romantic love. And that's why we really have to go into that in detail in order to clarify it completely. But it is important to realize that that kind of thing is very, very present in Wentworth's relationship with this second Adela, because she is not the real thing, and she's somebody that can be manipulated. She's somebody that comes out of his head, out of his own needs, and he fabricates her so that she fits it. And he says, it really is really perfect. It's a perfect perfect description of it. He had never understood that simplicity before. It was so clear now. He looked at the woman opposite and felt a stirring of freedom in him. He said, "You waved?" And she, "Oh, didn't you wave to me?" he said under her eyes. "I didn't think you'd be any use to me." She laughed. The laugh was a little like Adela's, only better, fuller, more amused. Adela hardly ever laughed as if she were really amused. She had always a small condescension. Now, you see, the thing is, he's just, you know, fixed up this person so she fits exactly what he wants. And it's just really neat, you know. And as I say, when Adela finally does come to see him in despair, because she really wants to get rid of, she doesn't want to live with Hugh, he's too authoritarian, she's decided she really wants Wentworth. And she, at least she wants to resume friendship with him. And he doesn't even want to see anything to do with her, because his own Adela is so much better than the real thing. Now, that also happens with people in religion. And this is why I'm such a stickler, in my own life anyway, and I think for people, generally I think it's important to make a consistent use of the Psalms and the Old Testament in order that you don't get yourself fabricating a picture of God that fits your little cozy, you know, idea of some poetic thing, you know. Oh, I don't like those. Oh, I don't like those pictures of God one way or the other. I mean, you may not like the usual heads of Christ that have all his dark hair and a limpid, lush eyes. But on the other hand, you maybe don't like an Old Testament God that swashbuckles around with, you know, wheeling over all the babies and telling everybody to be crushed because they don't believe in the right thing. I mean, you don't want that either. So then you fix up a little neat thing of your own. And you can read all through the New Testament, and you can fit it all in and just, you know, drop off the things that you don't like and put in the things you do, interpret things the way you want to. And before you know it, you've got the same thing that Wentworth had. You see? It's so easy. And that's why, you know, you can say hallelujah and praise the Lord for the scriptures, because they keep you from making up your own God. Okay, if you're going to make up your own God, then say he's your own kind of God, and you don't care for that, so you've decided to fix something up that fits your own needs, your own aesthetics, you know. And I agree, you know, the Bible is not very aesthetic. And so if you want an artistic representation of God, that's not the place to find one. So it's not just, it isn't just in terms of you know, a romantic relationship that this is true. It happens all the way along, and you know, you can discover that. But that's important in terms of the way in which what happens to Wentworth in terms of his life with this second Adele.
In part, isn't the real Adele responsible, you know, even in the evil sense, well responsible for us, for each other, but she's responsible for what Ruth just said, you know, by the game she plays? And
oh, yeah, to begin with. Yeah. Yes, and you know, Hugh says, you know, she didn't like that little pretty way she was flirting with him, with Wentworth, and she liked to have him kind of keep him on the hook. But she wasn't as responsible for him because she hadn't really gotten involved totally with him, you know, as totally. If she had been a, you know, if she had allowed herself to be a person who could be involved in the way of exchange, then she wouldn't have been, you know, she wouldn't have done that. But she herself was equally, you know, on the negative side. So her chance to repent and change, you know, they kept coming up, but she never took them. But she was definitely part of his descent, although he'd started somewhat on the way, I think, before she met him. Now I'd like to have you all bring up anything more, some other questions about Wentworth, if you have them, so we have a chance to sort of talk about him a little bit, and then go back to Pauline and her relationship with Stanhope, which is the other side of the coin.
Yeah, you said Gomorrah was a symbol of no choice.
Well, in this book it is. Mm-hmm. That's the way William sees it. He sees it as the last chapter, you know, is beyond Gomorrah. That's what happens to Wentworth when finally he, you know, the thing is that he goes and he if you look on the very last, I think it's the last, is it the last page? I think it's he goes to this big dinner, this big scholarship, this academia dinner, and is hoping to have a you know, thought he was going to be able to really, you know, somehow smash his rival, who was an elderly man who had done some real scholarship in the field, and he was always trying to undercut him and misinterpret. I think originally Wentworth, the thing about all of Williams' characters is that originally, you know, they start out with a fairly genuine set of virtues and vices, and they you know, they move along, and it's as they move into the circumstances of life that, you know, the things happen to them that finally send them either into Gomorrah or to Zion or eventually to hell or whatever, you know. People are not usually are not all good or all bad, although in the Greater Trumps there's Sybil has the character of someone who has apparently gone through the suffering earlier and has found her way to the kingdom and is living in the kingdom. And who's the obvious person in the descent into hell that sort of stands out at the very beginning, from the very beginning with a fairly strong descent? Mm-hmm. Stanhope, very much so, and Margaret, the grandmother. Remember, she goes through her experience of death. But in that, she's given, you know, she goes through a sort of a visionary kind of thing. But even before that, she is really a ready person, ready to go, ready to enter, her insights are all kingdom oriented, all in terms of sensitivity and you know, depth. As far as the way of exchange is concerned.
How about Mrs. Perry? Where is she from? They made that reference to
efficiency?
Of significance.
Yeah.
She wanted significance and Stanhope. Who was it? Pauline that was talking about symbolism?
Uh huh, uh huh.
Significance and symbolism. Uh-huh. Then they made the reference to the dress rehearsal.
Yeah.
In which Mrs. Perry was wearing a frock Mm-hmm. And Stanhope was wearing a light suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking whether it was Stanhope's word and hers directly was his minister.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's interesting that there are very few times when anyone is described in terms of what they're wearing, and that is an interesting thing that I hadn't realized that. I didn't remember that, but that's really interesting. I think that there's a section in here where Stanhope says that this is in the dress rehearsal chapter, and she, the thing about Mrs. Perry is that she is efficient. She's really serious. And the thing about Charles Williams is he doesn't ever undercut anybody who really is honestly trying to do something. You know, he's not going to say, well, you know, that person is really, you know, he's really out of it all the way. No imagination, no nothing, no this, no that. No, the thing about Mrs. Perry was that she was efficient and she really was serious about putting on this production. She wanted it to be a good production. And as he said, as William says, the great thing about her is that she would rather have had a good production than a full house if she had to make a choice. She'd rather have it be right and right on than have it popular and have a sellout. Now that says something for her kind of dedication to her particular goals. And Williams has a real sense of, I think this is true, that people who really pay attention to what they're doing and are really, you know, concerned about it, are, of course they get, you know, sometimes get blinders on, very often they do, and it's hard to get to them, and sometimes it's hard for the message of the gospel to come around and, you know, crack through all that efficient, you know, almost self-righteousness. And yet Williams is very adamant on absolute hatred of sloppiness and inaccuracy. He says hell is inaccurate. That's how he describes hell. And I think, oh, I'm glad that I've got the gospel to cover me. I know what I'd do if everybody had to judge my accuracy, because I'm the world's worst typist. But what he means is that if you're doing something, you do it with everything in you. And when you do that, there's a real possibility for being moved into the kingdom eventually, because somehow there is a kind of a ring of truth about you. Now that's an interesting angle, because usually, you know, we're kind of poo-pooing people that, oh well, you know, they take their job so seriously, they take this too seriously. And he doesn't think you should just go around taking everything seriously and being, you know, long-faced about it and everything, but he does feel that if you're going to be doing something, it ought to be carefully done. If you're responsible, you should be responsible, in other words. If you're not, well, then okay, you're not responsible. But you should be one or the other about certain things, but you can't be responsible for everything. See, now this is important, that you don't try to take responsibility for everybody in the world, or every job in the world, or in the village, but that you kind of have a criterion that checks you out. Now Simone Weil has a really good thing about that, I think. I don't know if that's the one that John referred to the other day. I don't know if he referred to her, but he was reading them, the notebooks. But in one of her essays, I think it's in The Need for Roots, where she talks about the importance of mathematics, of studying math, which really, you know, thrills me, because I have a very hard time with with advanced math. I can do simple arithmetic. But she says that she was writing, she was talking about her brother, and I think maybe it was from a letter that she had written to him, that she said, if you really pay attention to your mathematics, she said, you are learning the first lessons in religion, in faith. And now that does not mean that things work out necessarily geometrically, although Williams says that there's a great deal of geometrical patterning in the way the universe seems to be set up and the way life has a way of setting itself up. But what she's talking about is that the concentration on a problem really trains you to pay attention to the whole life of the scriptures and the life of faith, and that when you stop to think of it, all right, you're going to love God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole soul. And you start thinking, now, if you really concentrate on that, you see, if this presupposes, Jesus presupposes, when he talks about something like that, that you really are allowing this to really make you center down on this. Well, if you're really going to center down on that kind of concentration, it's the same kind of concentration in another way that you would, for instance, do with a really hard problem. Or if you were trying to solve a really difficult problem in translation, or a really difficult problem in trying to write a good sentence, any of those things, it just happened that you use mathematics because it's a given thing that you have to solve. But it's the kind of primary concentration that you put into solving a problem. And it's that kind of concentration that is essential if you really mean business when you talk about loving God with your whole heart and soul and mind. This is a total concentration. And that's the kind of thing, that's why when he says somebody does something honestly, when Williams talks about honesty and accuracy, it's that kind of a ramification that's involved in it. That if you talk to someone about really trying, finding out what it's like, you know, to obey the commandments or the 13th chapter, 1 Corinthians, that people seem to think is so simple, you know. Well, I don't believe in the God of judgment. I believe in the God of love, you know. 1 Corinthians 13. And Williams would say, well, all right, try it. Really concentrate on that and see what happens to you. And what he's saying is that if you've really been honest in and know what that means in working out a problem or cleaning out a cupboard or following a recipe and doing something with making something or whatever you happen to be doing, that you honestly do it with and really pay attention to what you're doing, then you can understand the language that says, now you apply the same kind of concentration to the things of the Spirit. You see what I mean? See where the honesty relationship comes in? It's not just accuracy per se, as if it were, you know, well, I do my job, you know, so I know I'll get to heaven. You know, it's not that kind of thing, but it's just that there is a real relationship here. And that's what he refers to.
He mentions the verses about to him who has more will be given.
Yeah.
Who has not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And wasn't that the part where it said that, and then Pauline said something about, but then the person that, wasn't there another conversation after that? That went on in it. And that's what Mrs. Perry was. She was efficient. She was careful. She paid attention to all the details so that production was a good one. And he says here, Peter Stanhope laughed and enjoyed and assented. And this is another thing that, just by the way, is really important when I talk about all this, you know, intensity and seriousness and concentration. The great thing about all through here is the fact that there's sort of a casualness about it, you know. Well, you know, okay, well, you know, he's not going to get so worried. I mean, Peter Stanhope isn't worried about the message of his play, and he says, well, okay, maybe we should drop the chorus, he says at the beginning. You know, maybe we shouldn't have the chorus in it. I think we should have a chorus. Oh, I think this should be called Trees. And then Pauline could be called the Oak. Well, you know, I mean, all these things come in, and you get the feeling that you know, life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. Is not the way Williams means for you to live. It's when you live really intensely that you really need the humor. And the humor comes because that's the gift of the Holy Spirit. I've always felt that, and I think Kierkegaard's statement is great on this, that because you take God seriously, you don't have to take yourself so seriously. And this is true in terms of your when you once let go and find out who God is, okay, then you can be lighthearted on occasion, and quite often. but it's important that you know when the occasions are, and that you don't slop around and just diddle around and be cute all the time, because of the fact that then that interferes with this whole accuracy bit. I just wanted to read this one thing from this dress rehearsal because it describes. Mrs. Perry, what Stanhope was, he willingly subordinated his own particular business to the business of others at their proper time. He seconded Mrs. Perry as far as and in every way that he could. He ran errands, he took messages, he rehearsed odd speeches, he fastened hooks and held weapons, but he only seconded her. The efficiency was hers, and the kingdom of God, which fulfilled itself in the remote recesses of his spacious verse, fulfilled itself also in her effective supremacy. Now that's a very important little statement of willingness, and this is part of the way of exchange, that you don't feel like you've got to be in control of everything. I mean, here he was the author of the play, and he really knew the way the play ought to be put on. But he'd given it into her hands, and she was efficient, and he helped her wherever he could. But he didn't try to take over and, you know, run it. And in his spacious verse fulfilled itself also in her effective supremacy. She stood in the middle of the field and looked around her. A few spectators were seated, the actors were gathering, Stanhope stood by her side. The prologue with his trumpet ran hastily across the stage to the trees which formed the background, and Mrs. Perry said, I think we're ready. Stanhope agreed. They retired to their chairs, and Mrs. Perry nodded vigorously to the prologue, and the rehearsal began. And that really is a really, really good expression. And they really, there's a lot of time spent on Mrs. Perry. Mm-hmm. She really is really developed, and I'm glad you brought her up because she's important.
But not at the end.
Oh yeah, but you see, she's not a focal character. I mean, that is, nothing has happened to her to change her. The only people that really are talked about to any great extent are people for whom change occurs. And those are the people that are important in Williams's novels, where change happens.
The people that we're talking about symbolism with. Mrs. Perry had significance and just stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Perry, I thought of a paring knife.
Or parrying to.
Yeah. And every time I came up, I thought of that. But Adela was talking about symbolism.
Mm-hmm.
And things got, in the symbolism, you can change it.
Mm-hmm.
It gets
mm-hmm.
vague.
Oh, yes.
And those people that.
Mm-hmm. And she and Mrs. Perry disagreed with some of the things. She thought things could have been improved in the play. She says a couple times that she thought there were some things that she thought could have been changed, but she didn't change them. You know, she stayed with it. Another thing that is important, right with that, in that same chapter, when we're talking about Wentworth's temptation and his descent into hell, is the statement at the when Wentworth has a chance to come back. He comes to the dress rehearsal and he has a chance to make a turn. Now it's a very funny turn that he could make, a very, what we might say is unimportant. It was something the matter with the costume. Now he was the one that was the authority on the military costumes of the period. Now you could say, that's not important. I mean, you know, after all, what would those people at that in that suburb know? What do the average people know about a play if the costumes are exact? Because this is really a very infinitesimal kind of thing. I'll read this part to you. Wentworth was strolling along, and Pauline said, the question was asked, is the Grand Duke's guard correct? Wentworth saw in a flash, in spite of his diagrams and descriptions, they had got the shoulder knots wrong. Mm-hmm. All wrong. The 18th century had never known that sort of thing. He looked at them for the first moment, almost with the pure satisfaction of the specialist. He almost, somewhere in him, joined in that insane jangle. No, 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 the guard is wrong. Oh, wrong. Say, I say. He looked, and he swung as if on his rope. Now, you see, he's always on this rope. Wentworth is. He's always on this rope, swinging, you know, over the abyss. Wondering if he's gonna go down farther. Sort of hand over hand sort of thing. He looked and he swung as if on his rope, as if at a point of decision to go on or to climb up. He walked slowly along the line, round the back, negligent of remarks and questions, outwardly gazing, inwardly swinging. After that first glance, he saw nothing else clearly. Say yes or no. The shoulder knots could be altered easily enough, all 12, in an hour or so's work, or pass them, take us as we are, say yes. They could be defended then and there with half a dozen reasons. They were no more of a jumble than Stanhope's verse. But he was something of a purist. He did not like them. You see, Wentworth knew they were wrong, and he didn't. Now, he was something of a purist. You see, he did have this honesty part of him. Somewhere along the way, he'd been doing some scholarship. He knew what was right. He even knew what was right with costumes. He didn't like them. His housekeeper, for that matter, could alter them that evening under his direction and save the costume makers any further trouble. Is the Grand Duke's guard correct? A voice penetrated him. Hugh was saying, one must have one's subordinates exact, mustn't one? There was the slightest stress on subordinates. Or was there? Wentworth looked askance. He was strolling superb by his side. Pauline said, we could alter some things, of course. His silence had made her anxious. He stood away and surveyed the backs of the guard. He could, if he chose, satisfy and complete everything. He could have the coats left at his house after the rehearsal. He could do what the honor of his scholarship commanded. He could have them returned. It meant only his being busy with them that one evening, and concerning himself with something different from his closed garden. He smelt the garden. That was all he needed. He smelt the garden. You see, this Eden kind of thing. He was reminded of these romantic evenings he was spending with this being of his, and his completely isolated existence is really going into a complete, what do you call it when somebody is in a nervous breakdown where they really close themselves off from everybody and live all only, I know in philosophy it's solipsism, but I don't know what it is in psychology. When somebody is a you know, completely closed off from everybody.
Just as an ego,
something. It's a completely private world. You just live in your own world, and that's what he was doing. And you have no responsibility for anybody. You don't have to talk to anybody. You don't have to deal with anybody. And this dream of his could be manipulated. Okay, well, that's the way it happened with Wentworth, and that was his chance to move. You see, he could have moved right then. He could have started climbing back up the rope instead of climbing. If you don't climb down, instead of coming down. Mm-hmm. But he didn't, and so that was his turning point.
Is there a another topic on the meaning for the name Periel.
I don't know about that. I was going to look it up because I wondered the name. What did it?
Did you find something really interesting?
Did you?
Peri, P-E-R-I. Uh-huh. The definition for that is one of a race of beautiful fairy-like beings of Persian mythology, represented as descending from fallen angels, excluded from paradise until their penance is accomplished.
Ha! That's really good, isn't it? That really fits Pauline.
And I was wondering, you know, why did William select that name for Pauline? Uh-huh. Last three words, until the penance is accomplished.
Yeah. Because that's exactly what she did. I'm so glad you looked it up. Where'd you find it?
It's in the mythology? American
College Dictionary. Yeah. It is! Imagine that. What a good dictionary. Imagine having...
I looked up the Greek thing. and one of the definitions, besides encircling, is close at hand.
Uh-huh. No, that did, I know. No, I didn't think it was that, because I knew I knew Perry. You know, it meant that means going around something, but that's really good.
It's
because
not Greek,
Persian. And you know, those Inklings must have had a lot of dealings with Persian mythology, because that's where Aslan comes from too. The name of Narada. And you know,
that sounds like the god
Tashkent. Yes, and Tashkent. Yeah, right. But now, are you getting tired of sitting?
No.
Because you can go, you know, nobody has to stay. These kids have to stay because they have, this is part of the class, but you don't have to stay. I worry about his back.
Well, my schedule is reopened.
I know your schedule is, but I didn't know your back was. Mm-hmm. And I know how terrible Carol would get, his back hurt so finally after he sat that he'd have to leave. He'd have to stand up and walk around. Well, I think when you talk about, as long as we're sort of beginning on Periel, that's a good way to move into Pauline, because that's a really interesting thing in terms of so many different angles of Williams's theology and his understanding of the faith and the way it all works out. Did any of you have any trouble with the understanding or with the explanation of her particular problem at the beginning?
It's like how you said
the doppelganger,
and then having to go back and say, "What did I miss?" And so I reread,
and then it began to make sense. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if anybody has to be doing something with the skiing things, you know, you can leave.
Oh, you should.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm all right in here. I wouldn't have been able to keep on any longer in the lifestyle room, but this room is so clean. The problem with the what you would call the heroine, if there is one in the book, is that she has, and ever since she's been young, she's had this problem of seeing herself coming. For instance, if she were going to come up from Koinonia or from the hotel up to the hospital here, she would be really frightened, because very likely, as she came up the path, she would see herself coming down the path, maybe from Schellenhain, and she had this terrible fright. What would happen if she met herself? I mean, just imagine. What if you really thought that you were coming, coming to meet yourself? I mean, I don't ever want to see I don't even like to look in the mirror very much. So I really don't really think that it would be fun to have to look at myself come walking down and meeting me. But you can imagine what a screwed up kind of frightening thing that is. It doesn't seem strange to me that it was frightening. But when she tells, and the first part of the book is involved with her fear, and the first time that Peter Stanhope sees her, when they come to start talking, they all come together in this fancy suburb of London to talk about the play that they're going to put on, he notices right away that she has a real anxiety And he begins to talk to her gradually and converse with her, and finally finds out in the process that this doppelganger, this phenomenon, has been part of her life since she's been a child. And so this is what hangs over her as such a fear. Now, he says that he will carry this fear for her. He said, I'll take that for you. I'll carry it for you. And she really is embarrassed and says that, oh no, I can't let you do that. And anyway, you couldn't do it. Well, he said he could do it. He can do it. She said, I can take it for you. I can't take the actual experience, but I can take the fear of the experience from you. Now, this is, I think Williams is one of the few people that I've ever read who actually images out in characters and plots the real meaning of being Christ for one another, which Luther talked about. We talk about that we're going to be brothers for each other. This is more than being a brother. This is actually substituting for somebody else. And he says, he said, well, you'd let me carry your groceries or books or what have you. if they were heavy, wouldn't you? Well, there's no difference. Well, there was a difference, but at least he put it on sort of an objective kind of basis, so that it was clear that he really meant it. He wasn't being funny. He wasn't just talking. And it did mean, and this is something that I think in our glib talking about being Christ for one another and being brothers and identifying with each other and so on. As I said last time when I talked about the fact that we so often think that it's just a kind of an elevated form of counseling in which you just listen to somebody's troubles and then you give them some good, wise advice. I mean, that's not suffering for that person, and it's not taking over anything. And I don't know how you do it, I mean, really, but in a certain sense, there are ways, I think, that this, I'm sure, has happened to you in ways that you maybe wouldn't have identified with this particular instance, but it does, and it will happen. And probably the important thing is that you don't know that it has happened in some respects, that you don't, hang it on your belt as a scalp. Well, I did substitute once. I did a way of exchange once. And so, well, I think it's true that, for instance, there are times when you really take over somebody's problem and actually suffer over that person in prayer. And really, the fact that you know about that situation is such a burden, and is such and you know that because that person has been able to tell you, although you've not really been able to say anything wise or counsel-y or anything to that person, you, still the fact that person has poured the burden on you, you are left with it to hold it. You can't tell anybody else. Nobody else really can know about it. But you have to pray about it. You're the one that has to sit up at night with it and think about it and worry about it and be concerned about it, because that person has been willing to trust you with it. And yet, because of the trust and the handing over of that problem, then it's your responsibility to pray and to enter into that kind of experience that the person is in. Now, that's the closest I can think of, and I wouldn't have thought of that, at least, but I think that's true.
From another, turning it around, when you're a parent, although it isn't something very popular, the idea of parenting now, it seems to me that that's the kind of parent, the way you operate as a parent, not to take things, to don't give things to your child before. Corey Tenzin has such a good image of her father carrying the briefcase for her. Mm-hmm. Her father tells her that. Mm-hmm. I think it's when she's interested in what sex is about.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, well, here, hold my briefcase. And she's carried to the tank station. And it's too heavy, I can't carry it. I'm only five or something like that. And he said, well, that's sort of like the question you're asking. You're not really old enough to carry it yet. I can't carry that. I'll carry it a little longer, and when you're big enough, I'll carry it.
That's a really good way to put it. I'd forgotten that.
I think it is too, but the trouble is that you don't always know what things are going to be too young. No. You really are living in a kind of participating way with children, and you have to spend an awful lot of time with small ones, I think, to do that.
Yeah, right.
But that kind of, it's like an inverted thing. When you're a parent, you don't give what they can't carry, and when you're a brother, sister, you know, quite equal,
you do
try to carry for them when you see they can't hold it anymore.
Simone Weil had some things that when I read her first book, that I read some things about. And it doesn't mean that you buy people's suffering.
Oh, no.
And I think so oftentimes I cross the line, I think as a Christian, why should we, you know, extending and exchanging and helping? But there are times, and she put it, there are times when you're called in the path of good and you're not to overstep that goodness. And in doing so, you buy someone, and perhaps that means allowing the person to carry their own suffering for in a kind of fullness of time.
And she does, you see, like as Steve says with the name. The interesting thing about Williams's theology is that he has this kind of penance, purgatory idea, which is foreign to us as Protestants, and yet it's not on the basis of any kind of it's not a kind of a works thing as you're buying your salvation or anything like that. It's because you are exchanged, because you have been unburdened, you are ready to share somebody else's burden, and that's where what the definition says calls it a penance. What it does is it allows you, because you're no longer burdened with this thing, you are at once given the opportunity to do something about somebody else. And this happens in every novel, every one of the novels. How many of you have read The Place of the Lion? Do you remember what's her name, Damaris, when she, as soon as she is freed from her burden, she has to go out in this very scary area. Always, these areas are always so scary, and these girls always have to go in such dark, awful places. And I get just boom, and I think, oh, I'm glad nobody asked me to do that. But she right away has to go and find the guy that was trying to help her. You know, that he was really trying to help her, and she would have nothing to do with him at the time. She just was kicking him. In fact, she kicked him in the face to get rid of him. And her job then, when she is freed, she knows what she has to do. She just makes a beeline for that really enchanted area outside of the town where she has to go and do this kind of thing. And that's what Pauline does. And you remember what it says about, I think it's in the chapter of the tryst of the world. Say, Elise, do you want to open that door a little bit? The front door? Margaret is, you know, Margaret is, the grandmother is dying, and she suddenly, just before she dies, well, it's not just before she dies, but she's sort of in a kind of a semi-coma, and the nurse tells her Pauline that her grandmother has called for her. So she comes in there, and she asks her grandmother what she wants, and her grandmother says that she wants her to go up to this particular place, and it's right in front of Lawrence Wentworth's house, this really crummy gentleman that we've just been talking about that has this friend and this pseudo-Eden that he's living in. And she goes to the nurse says, oh, that's all right. She said, don't worry, you know, just say that you're going, you know, and you can come back. She doesn't know what she's talking about. She's just rambling. And Pauline says what? Do you remember? Remember what she says? Remember that neat statement? Well, she says
she her grandmother really wouldn't know if she would go, but there was something about her telling her that she was going to fulfill that her promise.
Right. She says it's on page 159 in this edition. She says Margaret has told her that she's told her about her ancestor. She had this ancestor who was a martyr of the under the persecutions just before the when under Mary when Mary was queen and she knew that he had been burned at the stake, and everybody said the thing that in George Fox's Book of Martyrs which was the reference point, he died with joy. Behold, I've seen the salvation of the Lord, or something like that. And it was a really great, victorious kind of fiery furnace that he went up in. Well, page 157. I think this is kind of important because of the fact that it does explain a little bit about Margaret's. Margaret and Pauline's relationship. Margaret, they're talking about how could Pauline do anything for this ancestor of hers. She said, that's impossible. She said, he's my ancestor. This is four centuries later. I'm here. I'm related to him, but he's already dead. How could I do anything for him?
I'm giving backwards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And she said, she saw Margaret's smile flash at her across rocks. It went, and the voice said, you think it's yours? Pauline answered abruptly, checking abruptness. I don't, do I? You think one of the two is yours, joy or misery, Margaret said, or both? Why, if you don't, should you mind? Pauline, for a minute, struggled with this in silence. Then, evading it, she returned to time. 400 years, she exclaimed. Child, her grandmother said, I can touch Adam with my hand. You aren't as far off. But could he take it before I'd given it? Pauline cried, and Margaret said, now this is important. Why do you talk of before? If you give, you give to it, and what does it care about before? Now it, of course, is just her way of saying God and his whole love for the world and his compassion. And in God there is no historical time. The historical time takes place on earth. But in God, there is an eternal now. George MacDonald has a wonderful little phrase where he calls it the holy carelessness of the eternal now. That's a marvelous little statement. But Williams is continually reminding us of the contemporaneity of God, that he is always now. He is not past, he is not future, he is now. And we are now to him. And therefore, when Jesus says, I am the God, not of the dead, but of the living. Abraham saw my coming and was glad. You know, when Jesus is talking in John there to the Pharisees. I mean, and Jesus is talking about it as if this is a continual, you know, and now the Pharisees, how can you talk like that? You know, they're our fathers. How can you say that they saw you? You didn't see them, you know. And then Jesus says, you know, before Abraham was, I am. And it's the I am-ness of God that is so powerful. But we never take ourselves into that I am-ness relationship. That we are also in a relationship of I am with him. So that therefore there doesn't make any difference to him whether time is then or now or future, because he can do what he likes. Well, I don't propose that you should plan on doing anything with your ancestors, because I'm not going to be guaranteeing what would happen if you figure you're going to take care of their sins or their problems. But you see this is a kind of hypothesis that you can go along with in a novel and in an image, so that you can get the idea of what it is to be related to a God that is that present. Because our problem is that we do not let God be present to us. And therefore, you know, we have no challenge for him. You know, we can always throw him off because it's always in the past. But they had talked for a while about this, Margaret and her and Pauline, and then this was earlier. Then when Margaret was in bed, when the grandmother had gone to bed, and she was not asleep, but she had a feeling that she had to call for Pauline. And this funny little Mrs. Samile, I don't know. S-A-M-M-I-L-E. Samile or something. Sort of a simile. Well, anyway, she's really a problem. And she's another temptation, another strange one that you could spend a lot of time on.
What does she offer?
Well, she offers any kind of temporizing, anything that will satisfy you for the present. I'll give you good dreams. Don't worry. I'll take care of your problems. You don't have to worry about anything, you know. You know, you can sleep well. You can have a nice thought. I can give you a lot of good things to think about. Well, you know, she's in on the opening of the graves at the very end. Yeah. You know where she belongs. Well, that's an interesting thing. But yeah. But read Daniel. What? Lilith is in the...
Right from Lilith?
Yes, that's... Well, not necessarily from George MacDonald's book, but Lilith was the supposedly the other woman. Of course we had to have another woman in Eden, even if she wasn't in the scriptures. You know. She's been put in to the Garden of Eden, into paradise. She was the other woman. Now, you know, that there's nothing said about her in the Genesis account, but the thing is that it was conceivable that God had made other people eventually, and she was the third one that came along, and she was really, you know, she gave Adam problems and Eve problems. She has a whole lot of, there are a lot of myths connected with Lilith, but. Well, I have to finish this first. Then we can go into a little of another time. But anyway, she was called to come see her grandmother. Mrs. Anstruther was sitting in the bed, propped by pillows, her eyes looking away. She dared not turn her gaze away. She said as Pauline came up, "Is that you, darling?" "Me," the girl answered. "Did you want me? Will you do something for me? Something rather odd?" "Why, of course, anything. What is it?" "Would you be so very charming as to go out and see if anyone wants you?" Mrs. Anstruther said quite distinctly, "Up by Mr. Wentworth's." "She's wandering," the nurse whispered. Pauline, used to Mrs. Anstruther's extremely unwandering habits, hesitated to agree, but it was certainly rather odd. She said with a tenderness a little fractured by doubt once, "Me, darling, now?" "Of course, now. That's the point. I think perhaps you ought to get back to the city." She looked around a little side. "Will you?" Well, she, you know... Pauline had been about to make the usual unfelicitous efforts of the healthy. Oh dear, this is so good. The unfelicitous efforts of the healthy to persuade the sick that they are being rightly served. But she could not do it. No principle and no wisdom directed her, nor any conscious thought of love. She merely could not do it. Now, you see, there was no... She wasn't marshalling up a lot of virtue and saying... "Well, I've got to be good now. I've got to show that I love my grandmother because I really do." She didn't. She just instinctively she couldn't do it because she was a changed person. She couldn't go against what had happened to her that had completely changed her whole being. And she wasn't consciously being good or loving or sweet. She was just being herself, and she couldn't do it. She said, "By Mr. Wentworth, very well, darling." She could have helped, but did not, adding, "I don't think it's very likely." Now that's a very typical Williams kind of a remark. She could have helped, but did not, adding. You know what you usually say? She could not have helped, adding. Mm-hmm. It's a really gets you, you know, really have to go back and say, what did she or didn't she? She didn't. No, said Margaret, and Pauline was gripped by a complete sense of folly. I don't think it's, no. She said, I don't know a thing. I'll go and turn. The nurse said as she was there, sweet of you to be so nice. Come back in 10 minutes. So she won't realize the time. I'm going, Pauline said distantly and distinctly, as far as Mr. Wentworth's. I shall be as quick as I can. She saw a protest at the nurse's mouth and added, at once. Mm-hmm. And you see, she committed herself orally to the nurse and to her grandmother, and off she goes. And those of you who remember it, that this whole next section is like an elegy. It's like some kind of a poem written in prose, in which she goes up and she goes through this whole place of the moon and the wind, and the edge of the other world was running up along the sky, the world where everyone carried themselves, but everyone carried someone else's grief. Alice in Wonderland, sweet Alice, Alice sat by the fire burned. Who sat by the fire that burned a man in another's blood on the grass of a poet's house, where things were given backward and rules were against rights and rights against rules, and a ghost in the fire was a ghost in the street, and the thing that had been was the thing that was to be, and it was coming, what was coming? What but herself? She was coming up the street, and the wind, herself. A terrible good. Terror and error. But the terror was error, and the error was in the terror. And now all were in him, for he'd taken them into himself, and he was coming down all the roads of Battle Hill, closing them in him, making them straight, make straight the highways before our God. And they were not, for God took them. In the world that was running through this, its wheel turning within this world's air, rolling out of the air, no peace but peace, no joy but joy, no love but love. Behold, I come quickly. Amen. Even so come. She caught up a hat and flung herself at the door, her blood burning within her as the house burned around. The air was fiery to her sense. She breathed a mingled life as if the flames of poetry and martyrdom rose together in the air within the air and touched the outer atmosphere with their interior force. Action was not yet so united with reaction as to become passion. The doubt she must have of what was to come took its old habitual form. Her past pretended to rule her. Now, I remember her past was this fear of the doppelganger, fear of her seeing herself coming. And she was going out at night. She never went out at night. She was scared to death to go out alone at night because she was always going to see this, you know, she had this feeling that this, she was going to come and meet herself. Her past pretended to rule her de facto sovereign, and her past was fear. And I think that's, you know, that's the whole description of Pauline's life. Her past was fear. It was midnight, the hill was empty, she was alone. It could only be that her ghostly image lay now in wait for her to emerge into its desolate kingdom. She grit her teeth, the thing must be done, she'd promised her grandmother. More important still, she'd promised the nurse. And I think that's quite important, that the external, you know, person, you know, you do something for your self-respect sometimes that you won't do for somebody you love. She might have confided to the verse first what she would never concede to the second. It was then that she saw the telephone. So she goes to the telephone and calls
Stanhope.
Well, and what happens when she calls Stanhope?
She's relieved.
Yes, and what does he say? She says, when she calls him, what happens to her? She calls him because Stanhope had told her that if she ever was frightened, anytime, call me up. Well, it's like Alcoholics Anonymous. If you feel tempted, call me up. Well, it's not that much different, you know. It doesn't make a difference. Night or day, call me up. And this was late. This was, you know, past midnight. And she stands there in the telephone booth and tries to decide whether she should call or not. And when she decides to call him and she hears his voice, what happens to her? What does she say? Do you remember? She said, the occasion, she said, is that I'm going, he wants to know what the trouble is. He's already, doesn't make a difference. He woke up out of a sound sleep. The occasion, she said, is that I'm going out up the hill because my grandmother's asked me to, and I was a little afraid just now. I'm not afraid. You know, all of a sudden, she calls him up. She's on the phone, and she, you know, she's supposed to get comfort and strength, and she finds out she doesn't need it. She's not afraid anymore. Oh, blessed, blessed, Stanhope murmured, but whether he thought of her or the omnipotence, she did not know. He added to her, go in peace. Would you like me to come? No, of course not, she answered. And lingering still a minute, said, I thought I wanted to ring you up, but when I did, I didn't. Forgive me. If it gives you any pleasure, he said, but you might have needed forgiveness, in fact, if you hadn't. God's not mine. Pardon, period, like love, is only ours for fun. Essentially, we don't and can't. And that's one of the greatest things, and I think if you have to, we have to leave, that's the best thing to stop with, is the fact that pardon and love don't belong to us. You know, you can't forgive anybody. You can't pardon anybody. It's because you live under forgiveness. It's already been done. The fact is there. And that's what's great, you know. God's not mine. Pardon, period, like love, is only ours for fun. Essentially, we don't and can't. Do you understand what that means? That really, you know, it's because forgiveness is the nature of God, and because of the incarnation and the whole crucifixion, the whole thing of Christ becoming man and taking us to himself, you know, we can live in the climate of forgiveness. And therefore, it's his forgiveness that we're simply living in and absorbing and using. And it's not because I'm such a forgiving person, he's a forgiving person. It's because we live in the power of the forgiveness. It's already a fact. And that's a great thing, not to have the possession. And that means you can really feel like that's where Kierkegaard's line comes in, very definitely, that when you take God seriously, you can't take yourself so seriously. It's not your, because you've really suffered and understood.
You have to ask for it, don't you?
Well, you ask for the forgiveness, that's different. But this is what I give to you. You know, if you do something that you feel you've got to, you know, you really, or if I've done something to you and I feel like I've really done something to you, I said something about her, I shouldn't have said, I've got to tell her. But, and you forgive me, but you don't forgive me. Mm-hmm. Because if you weren't living in forgiveness, you couldn't. Mm-hmm. You see, you can't forgive mm-hmm. by yourself. And so therefore, it isn't a possession. It's something that you live in. It's like Pauline's response when she said she couldn't do it. She couldn't say no to her grandmother. It wasn't because she was being loving. It wasn't because she was being strong or virtuous. It was because there was a change that had gone. She just couldn't do that. And then you don't run around, you know, thinking about how you're improving here and improving there and you know, I'm developing a little here and I'm developing a little there and, you know, it's getting better and better.